economic and revenue outlook. We have the economists here. Step forward, please. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, good morning.
Afternoon.
Afternoon, yes.
No, they're economists.
Time zone. That'll be forecast. That's for tomorrow.
Good evening.
Well, good afternoon, Senator Hannan, Representative Westland, members of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Petowski, state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Cora Parker, our revenue economist, also with the Office of Economic Analysis. You have in front of you a handout entitled Oregon's Economy and Revenue Outlook. We'll briefly go through this handout. I'll let you know a little bit about what's happening for the Oregon economy and the outlook. Cora will give you the revenue picture. So on page one of this handout, it starts off by saying that today's economy is the best the United States has seen since the 1960s. And I guess we want to emphasize that word today, because it's questionable right now as to the particular shape that the U.S. economy is in. We've had fantastic growth, over 4% for the last 3 years running. It looks like the year 2000 will also be above 4% when the numbers come in. But there's also indications that things have started to slow a little bit. The third quarter of 2000 only came in 2.2%. This normally would have been seen as not a bad growth rate, because it was believed that the long-run growth rate for the United States was around 2.7% before. Now they've raised this speed limit up to about anywhere from 3.5% to 4%. So a 2.2% really does represent some slowing in the economy. Some signs of slowing are evident. We've seen consumer surplus, consumer confidence has fallen the last 4 months in a row. We've seen a index from the National Association of Purchasing Managers, manufacturing index that it's at its lowest point since 1991, which is the last U.S. recession period. Consumer spending also seems to be slowing. And when consumer spending is two-thirds of economic activity, and that's also true here in Oregon, that slowing also represents a definite possible downturn coming for the economy. Bright spot still, though, is overall inflation does remain relatively low. On page two, the top graph shows sort of a history from mid-1970s of the U.S. economy. We're in the longest expansion right now since records have been kept since about 1874. So this is an unusual time right now.
Mr. Chair, just by observation, you can tell when my wife had her credit card and when she didn't.
But the expectation is that we had a little bit of a slowing during this expansion, and we had what the Federal Reserve describes as their soft landing. And then the economy took off once again. And what the hope for, and we'll discuss this a little bit later, the hope is that we have the second soft landing has now occurred, and that this will be the slowest that the economy will be at, and things will start to pick up after we get out of the year 2001. But when will it stop? Do all good things have to come to an end? It's still, as I said, the longest expansion of post-war history. Consumers, still the driving force, but they're showing signs of slowing. Inflation is still moderate, which is good news, because if you need to push the economy to get rid of inflation, that's usually been the stance of the Federal Reserve. Inflation got too high, they had to hammer the economy down in order to wring inflation out. Well, there's not that much inflation that needs to be wrung out, and that's a good sign. International markets, we've seen some good recovery in there. But Japan, and this is a real key for Oregon, still seems to be on the ropes a little bit. At least they're not declining at all. But they still, as we're in our longest expansion on record, they're in their longest downturn on record. Page three just shows you what's happening with the Federal Reserve. And believe me, you know, Greenspan gets the sniffles. We definitely catch the cold here in Oregon. And he did, with his group of associates at the Federal Reserve, raise interest rates six times up to May of 1999. Then finally, those higher interest rates started to take hold. And then just this past January 3rd, they lowered interest rates by half a percentage point. You want to keep in mind that in 1998, the federal funds rate, which is a risk of Federal Reserve targets, was around 4.75%. This recent drop was from a level of 6.5% down to 6%. So there's still room to try to be stimulative to the economy to move those interest rates down. And our forecast for the Oregon economy, which does include interest rates, does believe that the Fed has just started their job and they will gradually reduce interest rates down again. But you want to keep in mind, just as it took a year for the rise in the interest rates to start to slow down the economy, it's also going to take about a year once they start lowering interest rates before we start to see a turnaround in the economy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Just by looking at that graph, though, I don't see the 6% and I don't see the half percent reduction in January of 2001. Is that... Am I reading that graph?
You're reading the graph correctly, Representative Butler. This graph is showing the prime rate rather than the federal funds rate.
As opposed to the discount rate.
Okay. Yes. Right. But the rates are tied. So you once one rate goes up, they tend to go up together. Okay, on Oregon's economic revenue and review and forecast, and you'll have to excuse me, I've got a cold with the infection in both ears.
Yeah, and me too.
That's a little rough.
Are you sick, Cedric?
No, we always spend our time saying, would you talk more clearly, please? I think it's geriatric rather than nasal.
Yeah. on page four, the top graph, what we're trying to show here is a theme that you've seen before. It's trying to show the dramatic changes in the industrial composition of the state. A movement away from natural resource-based economy to one that is more diversified. And you can see this move from 50 to 98 in terms of employment. Lumber and wood used to be 15%, now it's 3%. Agriculture from 17% to 4%. Government increasing from 12 up to 16%. Most of that is local government. With the increases in population, the need for the K through 12 education. Services expanding from a 9% to 25%. So these are indicators of that diversification you've heard about for the Oregon economy. The chart down below on page four, industrial shift towards higher technology, you can see that first column, some very high growth rates in terms of the value of output from these industries, especially high tech growing at about 1,000%. The one thing I wanted to show in this graph, though, we're going to show these growth rates in the next chart. But if we look at the shares, and this is 1988 to 1998, the share says, well, what percent of overall output was related to these industries? And if you just take a look at the line manufacturing, and we look across to the right, manufacturing was 19.7% of the value of output in 1988. And then if you continue on that manufacturing line and look out to the last column, the share now is 28.4%. So the point I want to get across here is our manufacturing base is more diversified than it was in the past. But in essence, we've become a more manufacturing-based economy. So the industries itself are more diversified, but manufacturing tends to be a very volatile sector of the economy. And we are, depending on the industries that are hit across manufacturing, we are just as vulnerable to economic business cycles as we were when we were just dependent mostly on the lumber and wood industry. And we saw that to some degree with the past Asian financial crisis that hit across all our industries, the lumber and wood, the agriculture, and the high tech. So that's one point I wanted to get across to you when you hear about the diversification of our economy. Yes, we have a lot more different industries, but we're becoming, in a sense, a more manufactured-based economy.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Tom, are we double counting any of these figures? I mean, you're sitting there talking about 147% increase in manufacturing. You get down to high tech products. Are you counting the high tech and manufacturing at the same time?
That high tech is part of the manufacturing line, Representative Westland.
And I mean, that just the bold then is the composition of all of the lower.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
I'm not sure I know how to read this graph. If I have a very small industry that increases two or three times, it means one thing. If I have a very big industry that increases two or three times, it means something entirely different. I don't know what the baseline is here. Is there a way for me to know, or do I need to know?
Representative Hayden, the column that says 1998 value gives in a dollar amount here the size of the particular industry we're looking at. So as, for example, in 1988, lumber and wood had an output value of about six billion, where high tech had an output value of about 1.8 billion. And then as we look to 1998, we can see how that has dramatically changed, where we've had an actual drop in the value of output for lumber and wood and a very large increase for high tech.
Thank you. I missed that.
The next page, page 5, then just takes that first column in the previous chart and pictorially shows those growth rates. And you can see the very huge growth rate in the value of output for the high-tech sector. Likewise, you have almost a 52% drop in the lumber and wood area, and related to lumber and wood, printing and publishing, paper and allied products also have a negative drop.
Sure. What is that, FIRE?
FIRE stands for finance, insurance, and real estate.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, the story is that we had a fantastic growth in the mid-1990s here. Our economy became more diversified. High tech and services grew very rapidly. The construction boom also occurred. We had rapid in-migration, and incomes and wages were growing faster than the nation. We were finally starting to catch up to the rest of the U.S. From our devastating period of time of the beginning of the 1980s, where we really didn't start to turn the corner until about 85 in terms of incomes and wages. Page 6. That happy story started to fall apart a little bit as we got into 1998. You can see that our neighbor to the south of us, California, the beginning of the 90s, was not doing very well. But then along came the Asian financial crisis and really hit, especially our exporting sectors across our manufacturing industries. When your job growth really starts to slow up, and then, for example, your neighbor to the south of you, California, really starts to speed up and grow faster, the in-migration to the state really slowed quite tremendously. As we're looking out into this graph in 2002, 2003, we see a general slowing of both Washington and California related to the national slowing. Our export volume has picked up in the bottom graph. You can see the 99, we started to shoot up. We're looking at about a 15% growth right now in the exports, which is quite good. On page 7, shows the quarterly exports at the top by sector. The top line is high tech. High tech now is over 50% of the value of all our exports. But still lagging behind is both lumber and wood, and agriculture are having some problems. I alluded to the population change and net migration just earlier. As you see, in the beginning of the 1990s, we had some high in-migration shown by the line, but if you look to the right, that's starting to decline. And the reason is, as I mentioned, even though, for example, Money Magazine can say Portland is the number one place to live, if you have slow job growth, and one of your neighbors is having higher job growth, you're going to have a slowdown in migration to the state. It's basically the opposite of the picture of when everybody was leaving California and coming here. Now it's been reversed somewhat. That then, when you have slow migration, your manufacturing slows, and then your other non-manufacturing employment also starts to slow. So your services, your retail, wholesale, so across the board we start to get slowing. And we've had a slowing population growth from what was about 1.6% growth in the mid-1990s to about 1.1% growth now. Page 8, the top just shows some driver's license data. That's one of the ways we sort of look at, see how the in-migration is changing. And those top two lines there, the farther they're apart, the higher the in-migration. The closer those two top lines come together, the smaller the in-migration. And you can see how they've narrowed towards one another as we've looked at the 99-2000 period. So what does this all mean, what we're expecting for the Oregon economy? Now that we've seen in 1998, we had international factors slowing us down. Our exports started to pick up. Asian countries started to do a little bit better. But just as we started to pick ourselves back up, Greenspan and Company decided to slow the economy down. And we just substituted international factors that were slowing us for national factors that are slowing us, with the higher interest rates that were rising through the mid-1999 and basically stayed through the whole year until just recently. So what we're looking at is we're going to be slowing, but we expect in this year that we're in now, we're going to grow just a little bit faster, barely, than the U.S. economy. Only because the U.S. economy is going to have slower growth than our slow growth. Not that we're coming out to any boom period or any sort of expansion whatsoever. We're forecasting 1.4% growth for 2001. It looks like 2000 came in at about 1.4% also. So we're looking at a continuation of this below 2% growth that we've seen now since 1998. The thing we keep in mind, although we talk about slow growth, you still can talk to people that say, you know, I still have trouble hiring people, labor markets are still tight, unemployment rates are relatively low. For sections of the state, that is true. And what we're doing is sort of plateauing and holding our own. So we've got a very, very slow growth, but we haven't had a huge downturn occurring here. We've seen sectors of the state that have experienced some. And I'll be mentioning those as we get into some of the problems or risks for this forecast. But so I wanted you to keep in mind, you could always have a snapshot today. And if we look just today at the economy, you can say, well, it's not all that bad a shape. But we've got to look just into the future just a little bit. And now the future is looking, at any time during this expansion, is looking more questionable than we've ever seen it. I give you an example on page 9 at the top of high-tech employment. Once again, the slowing growth is the story we want to tell in here. We don't expect a boom period. You may have heard of Intel, who's our largest employer, has made an announcement that it plans by the year 2015 to have 6,600 more employees. I look at that and if I would forecast out to 2015, I might be able to make up a story like that, too. We believe that they're here to stay. They have been increasing employment. In 1999, in the second quarter, employment grew by about 8% at an annualized rate. In the third quarter of this past year, it grew by about 15% annualized. And the fourth quarter is around 10%. They've been adding quite quickly. But the addition here is kind of getting themselves back up to the pre-Asian financial crisis days. Whether they're going to keep continuing adding at that, especially with the news that we hear about reduced revenue growth projections for the high-tech industry, is a real question mark. So we're looking at positive growth for them, but we're not looking at any sort of boom period that we saw in the mid-1990s. Just a very small growth. Looking ahead, we think consumers still remain the key for the state. As I said, Oregon's going to go faster than the U.S. only because the slow growth on average of the U.S. is less than our slow growth. And we expect some recovery, and it has already occurred in Asian markets. We've seen that in terms of our exports going up. Still, some risk remains for the Japanese economy. The top of page 10 shows a comparison of our Oregon per capita income with Oregon average wage to the U.S. average. That horizontal bar there, if we would reach that bar, we'd be the same as the overall U.S. average for both of those measures. And you can see that we're below that bar for quite a while now. And this is a consequence, really, of the gut-wrenching period of lumber and wood decreasing before we had high-tech really taking off. It's tough to replace those very high wages that you saw in lumber and wood. High-tech is helping out, but as you can see, we have a ways to go before we reach back up to just where we were at the late 1970s. The risks to this forecast, this is our baseline forecast. We think it's the one that's going to happen, but we also have to be cognizant of the fact that these outlooks may change depending on certain factors in the economy, ones that we can hope try to forecast, other ones that would be out of our control. Macroeconomic policies. Right now, I think we might be leaning towards a mild upside positive to our forecast based on macroeconomic policies. We have the Federal Reserve deciding, yes, we put the fear of God in the economy. They're believers. The hard landing may happen rather than a soft landing. We've got to get the ball rolling in the opposite direction. And so they did this interest rate decrease between the regular meetings. They've only done that three times in the past 15 years. We expect them to decrease interest rates again at their meeting at the end of this month. It's possible, too. We also have, finally, a president-elect, and there was talk then of a tax cut plan. That plan to be phased in over a 10-year period. It probably will not be as strong as possibly the Bush party would like it to be, given the makeup in the Senate, the U.S. Senate. So if one comes through, it'll probably be of a milder stance. But that still would be stimulative to the economy. So I think of the macroeconomic policies right now, it's probably mostly mild on the upside to help us out over this period. International conditions. We've seen some of the economies doing better. One of the outlooks we have to look out for is the Middle East tensions. That could cause a very high price of oil to occur. So there is some worry about that. We're also, as I mentioned many times, worried about Japan. Japan has been one of our major export markets, especially for agriculture, lumber, and wood. And if they can pull out of the doldrums, that'll be beneficial. The scare here is that, you know, if the U.S. economy slows, that can tend to slow down the rest of the world. Energy prices. I see no upside to this, only a downside. And I tend not to be an extremist, so my saying moderate here as a risk is a strong statement on my part. We've had some very serious problems, especially in the West. With the energy situation in California, it's still very questionable how many industries will be hit across the board. We've already seen a number of aluminum smelters closing down. Very, very strange activities where an aluminum smelter can close down, pay all its workers their full wages, sell the energy back, and make more money than if they were making aluminum. These actions seem very insane to us, but if there are private businesses wanting to make money and they have contracts, it in essence makes sense for them to do that. You want to keep in mind, too, if they were not doing this and Bonneville had to get the energy, where would it get it from? And so this particular activity is probably helping in some respect, along with conservation efforts that we've been asked to do, to help alleviate rolling blackouts. But those are not out of the picture. Those are possibilities. The long term, we're looking at this. Generation should be starting to come online for electricity, but we're looking at a year to 2 years out. So you can have some pretty rough going in between that period of time. So we're watching that closely. Stock market. I put a 50-50 here, only because the way I describe it is I'm no fool. I'm not going to forecast it. But if the stock market stays down, we've lost something close to 40% on the NASDAQ over this year. If it stays down, sustained down, what does that do to the consumer? And the consumer is a driving force in the economy. If they believe, and consumers generally, especially in the U.S. and in Oregon, they're target savers. They save for college education for their kids. They save for retirement. And if now all of a sudden they see that they've no longer hit those goals because their portfolio is worth less, they may turn around and decide we need to save again, which is a natural reaction, what they should do. But unfortunately, when you do that very quickly, that means your only other choice is to spend less. And spending less is going to slow the economy down. So that is a risk also that we're looking at for the economy. Lastly, the high-tech industry is quite an unknown. And what I'm saying by this is that if we looked at revenue growth projections for sectors of the high-tech industry back in August, some of these sectors were looking and predicting 50% revenue growths. A couple of months later, they're slashed by more than half. So this is a very rapid turnaround for projections of this industry. And so we want to watch this very closely. The other thing that, though, we have to keep in mind, this industry, too, knows that if you're positioned when the upturn comes and you can supply the market, that you can make out like a bandit. So being able to still, in a sense, expand a little bit, keep your capacity up, even though times are getting a little tough, they may do so. But it is a very difficult call at this point. It depends on how deep the downturn is expected for high tech. But keep in mind, some industries would love to have the half of the forecast that high tech has. I mean, if now we're talking about the teens for revenue growth, some industries would love to have that. That'd be a real rosy outlook for them. The markets beat them down in the stock market because it's only in the teens rather than in the high 40% range. So there's still, I think, room then for growth given a positive revenue growth outlook, but much, much more subdued than what we were looking at before. Once again, although it's come down very rapidly, the risk is it could come down even further, and that may make the high-tech people start to cut back rather than employ. So our scenario with this, and my last slide on page 11, the economy feeds right into our revenue projections. And how well the economy does influence what we expect to come in for collections. So even though we're more diversified, we still have a very heavy dependence on high tech and lumber and wood. And they are cyclical industries. As the state moves more towards reliance on income taxes, revenues are more sensitive to income changes, and income changes are sensitive to the direction of the economy. And so far, we've been blessed that we've not really experienced a serious economic downturn since the passage of Measure 5 and Measure 50. And so we really don't know what the impacts may be if we do have a serious downturn, although as CORE is going to provide you with our baseline forecast for revenues, and then I believe Paul Warner is going to show you the possibilities of what may happen to revenues if we do have downturns. So I'd like to turn that over, unless you have questions right now for me, to CORE Parker for the revenue outlook.
Okay, Tom, thank you very much. Are there any questions by committee members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
When is our next revenue forecast, Tom?
Senator Yee, the next revenue forecast will come out on March 1st, which is our regular quarterly forecast, and that will give you some indication of any changes from the governor's recommended budget, which was based on our December 1 forecast, is what we're presenting to you today. And then May 15th will be, in essence, the sort of about final forecast that sets your legislatively approved budget will be on that date.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what do you predict the revenue forecast will be in March and May? Will you see a decline in revenue due to the slowdown of the economy, the increase in energy price, and general slowdown of the economy in the country.
Yes, Senator Yee, I'll give this in just some terminology of down or up. But if we look at our December 1 forecast, indications right now are that, first of all, I would stay with this forecast right now. Although we've had these changes and things look a little softer than when we did this December 1 forecast, I'm not sure I would change it by very much. If I would put a number to it right now, I might lower it from anywhere from 100 to 500 million. But what we have to look at is what's been happening to withholdings, what's going on with our refunds. Corporate profits have been weak, although we just hear today, I have not heard exactly what Intel profits came in. They have, as they've stated before in the press themselves, that they pay the highest percentage of corporate taxes. They may actually reach now their fourth quarter goals, where it was questionable before. So we've got to keep in mind all these items. But right now, if anything in the direction it's going in, if any direction we might take revenues, it would be just slightly softer than what we see today.
And another question.
Yes.
So you talk about a range between 100 to 500 million. So if we take the middle, are we looking at very possible 200 to 300 million?
Yes, Senator Yee, very possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to put the word possible, because we've got to, we're looking at the statistics. We have revenue figures that come in daily. So I have to emphasize that word possible. Probability-wise, I put a higher probability on that revenue forecast coming down rather than it going up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Cora, welcome.
Thank you. Senator Hannan, Representative Westland, members of the Ways and Means Committee. As Tom mentioned, and as you are all aware, the economic forecast feeds directly into the revenue forecast. In addition to those inputs, we all, again, as Tom just mentioned, track what's going on with collections at Department of Revenue on a daily basis in some instances, and definitely on a daily basis during the legislative session and when you're putting together your budget, because we know it's very important that we get the revenue forecast as close as possible to what reality is going to be. Today I'm going to outline again the December 2000 forecast for you. I'll provide sort of an overview of what both lottery and general fund revenues have been over the last decade or so. And then I'll give you a brief update on what we see going on with withholding and refunds and some of the other information streams that we have coming in. So that, again, as Tom, you can tell, was very cautious to give sort of a too quick of an answer of what we think the next forecast will be. But I can give you some indication of what actual collections have been, at least, and that can help you, in a sense, understand at least the data that we're working with as we put together that next forecast. And for your information, we're just now starting that cycle where we'll start to work on the economic forecast for the March 1 release date, and then in about a month to month and a half, we'll actually be putting together the final revenue forecast. So you see that there's still actually quite a bit of information that's yet to come in before we can release those numbers. If you'll turn to page 12 in your forecast, I'll quickly go over 99-2001, basically just to give you a sense of where we'll be ending the biennium. Looking at the December forecast, we are expecting total general fund resources of about $10.5 billion for the biennium, and looking at an ending balance of $461.1 million. That's what you'll have to begin the next biennium with. We're still continuing to call for both a corporate and a personal income tax kicker. And again, those will be refunds from the 0103 biennia. That's important to note. I'll come back to that later, but that could have some impacts on what revenues look like when we come out with the March and the May 15th forecast. Looking at lottery resources for the 9901 biennia, we're expecting total resources of just over $601.2 million. We're actually expecting transfers from lottery to remain at the close of session level. That was based on an agreement that allowed lottery to keep amount above the close of session forecast for purchase of video lottery terminals for this biennium and future biennia. We're looking at an ending balance, and again, beginning balance from your standpoint, of $5.6 million for lottery funds. Moving into 2001-03, the December forecast again, we're looking at total revenues of just over $11 billion for the general fund. That includes about $9.4 billion from personal income taxes, $919 from corp, and just under $700 million for other revenue. That's an increase of 7.7% from this biennia. We're looking at total resources, again, including that beginning balance figure, just under $11.5 billion for the biennium. The PIT forecast was actually down somewhat because of the impact of Measure 88. That was approximately $160 million impact, but because of actuals and some other economic forecast information coming in at that time, there was a bit of an offsetting increase that would have occurred had that measure not passed. So you looked at a downturn of about $100 million from the September forecast to December. The corporate forecast was up slightly. Again, this is a very volatile source to try and forecast as far as what's going to come in on a quarterly basis. We feel like we've, as far as liability goes, and as far as getting a pretty good handle on what that forecast is overall, but trying to forecast quarterly is fairly difficult for the corporate forecast. And that's something that you see around the country. That's not just true for Oregon. Other general fund revenues were up by about $110 million. Those revenue sources include liquor monies, cigarette and other tobacco tax monies, criminal fines and assessments, interest, a myriad of other pieces that flow into the general fund. Important to note that tobacco settlement monies are not included in the general fund forecast. Those are separate at this point in time. Looking at lottery resources for the 2001-03 biennia, we're looking at total transfers of $623.1 million for the biennia. That's about a $19 million increase from September. Resources available for you to appropriate after dedicated distributions for the Education Endowment Fund, Parks and Natural Resources, debt service, the other list of items that come out of there, leave you with just over $300 million available to appropriate from lottery resources. The next chart that we show just outlines lottery resources available to the state over the last few biennia. Well, since the history of the lottery began, actually. You can see that we're forecasting that the stream of revenues coming in is going to stabilize, well, has stabilized, and will continue to be at a relatively stable figure. But you'll also note that the amount of dedicated distributions coming out of those resources has continued to grow over the last few biennia, at least, and it's an increasingly larger piece of that pie. General fund revenues, if you look at the next graph, have grown considerably over the last couple of decades from $2.2 billion in the 77-79 biennia to projected at $14.4 billion in 2005-07. So considerable growth over that time. The next graph, however, sort of puts things in perspective of how that compares to inflation and the long-term growth rate during that period of time. You can see that while the growth in revenues has outpaced inflation. It's pretty steadily followed the same pattern, at least, during that period of time. And the average growth during the period has been about 13% for general fund revenues. The next chart we call our black and white graph. This will be something that you'll probably see repeatedly from us during the session. This just shows how large refunds such as kickers, the federal income tax, or excuse me, the federal pension refunds, and other things that are sort of outside of economic forecasts can distort growth rates from biennia to biennia. If you look at the white bars, that shows growth in actual total collections. But the black bars show what growth would have been without those refunds. So just a total straight economic picture from biennia to biennia. And you can see that there's a shift. There's a big shift in some places. If you look at it in 2005-07, you see that they're equal, and that's because at this point in time, at least, we're not forecasting any large refunds or any large items that are outside of the true economic-related forecast. Something that's been a discussion of late related to the revenue forecast is capital gains and what their impact are on the revenue forecast. What role have they really played? Well, they're a relatively small piece of the pie as far as taxable income coming into the state, but it can't be ignored that the source has been growing. While capital gains was less than 4% of adjusted gross income in 1990, it was greater than 8% in 1998. So it's becoming a relatively larger piece of the total pie. But as you can see from the chart there showing growth in taxable capital gains versus personal income growth, it's a very volatile source when it comes to growth, at least. There have been periods where we've had phenomenal growth and periods where we've actually had slightly negative growth compared to the prior year. So hard to get a handle on. A lot of that, again, relates to what's going on in the stock market, which, as Tom has mentioned and we're all aware, is very volatile itself, and especially of late. So difficult to get a real handle on what's going on. Again, taxable capital gains, very difficult to predict, but we obviously do try and get somewhat of a handle on it. Obviously, if the stock market were to go into a long-term sustained decline, then we would see capital gains decline over the long term. Short-term implications are much more difficult to get a handle on. If we see a lot of selling, a lot of capital losses, you could see in the short term at least, possibly those who got out of the market in time could actually have capital gains. So we could have a short-term influx of capital gains. At the same time, we could have those who didn't get out in time and see a lot of capital losses offset those. So there are some implications that are real difficult to get a handle on, and we're obviously watching that very closely over the next several months and next several years and trying to pull in as much information as we can for our forecast. Whatever the scenario ends up being in the short term, though, it is expected, both information that we're assembling from other states, what the Congressional Budget Office is using, that they will not continue to grow at least at the same rates that we've seen them growing. So that will begin to slow, and that has been built into our forecast already. And I believe that Paul, in his presentation today, will speak somewhat to capital gains again and what the implications are for some different growth rates in that source. The next page that you have shows the history of the 2% kicker. You can see that there have been years when there have been no kickers in the past. If you look to the early 80s when we had slow economic times, so although kickers have sort of been a given in the last few biennia because of the phenomenal growth that our state has benefited from, they're not necessarily a given in the future. And as Tom likes to point out, you know, our baseline, we would obviously create a forecast assuming that there would be no kicker, that we're going to be right on. So one of these days, unfortunately for everyone who enjoys the windfall, we're probably going to hit it. And There's also the possibility that it will be below. So we basically, I'm trying to make the point that you can't rely on it. When the economy starts to slow, the chances of being over forecast are increasingly declining. Finally, a revenue update. As far as personal income tax collections go, withholding has continued to really come in very strong compared to forecast. We've not seen a decline in withholding at all. As a matter of fact, it's been slightly above forecast for the last quarter. Corporate collections have been fairly strong in the last quarter. Again, though, because of the volatility on a quarterly basis of that source, that doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of where that forecast is going long term. We'll need to look at refund data over the next couple of months. Will be very important for the May 15th forecast, at least.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Corey, is that with regard to the corporate income tax collections, are those as to closed fiscal years, or are those as to all collections, including the estimated taxes?
Senator Hannon, Representative Butler, it's all collections. And as you're probably well aware, when we put our forecast together, we look at liabilities that we know are associated with a given year, but not everyone, as you know, pays that liability exactly when it's due. There's a real lag, and especially with the corporate forecast, because of the timing of a corporate tax year. While personal income taxpayers are all on a calendar tax year, that's not true for corporate income taxpayers. They can have many different tax years as long as it starts within a calendar year. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
By way of follow-up, you track that by month to month with the prior year and prior years, then so that irrespective of when their corporate year may close off, their quarterly payments would still be made in the same quarter if they are in fact estimating and paying their quarterly. Same is true with regard to individuals, and I don't want to create too much problem, but there are a number of individuals who do have fiscal years other than calendar years. So,
if I understand your question, then I would agree with you, and perhaps we should even talk after the meeting to make sure that I do. But basically, the story is that collections are, at this point at least, continuing to come in strongly. So we haven't, at least to date, seen impacts associated with the economic slowing that we know is going to occur. But February, March, April are going to be big months to track what's happening as far as refunds are related and as far as final payments. So fortunately for the May 15th forecast, we'll have the benefit of those actual collection data coming in before that forecast. A final word about potential kicker impacts with respect to timing of the slowing that we're going to see. If we don't see that slowing occurring until the next biennia, so we continue to bring in substantially over-forecasted revenues for this biennia, our kicker will continue to grow. But then when we see the slowdown in the next biennia, we'll just have a bigger refund that comes also out of that biennia, which actually could impact revenues even further as far as any potential decrease. So the timing of the slowdown that we know is going to eventually occur is very important as far as how it's going to impact the dollars that you have to work with as far as the budget is concerned. So something to really keep in mind over the next few forecasts that we release to you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions by committee members? Not Representative Hayden.
Just out of curiosity, how big a bump do you get each year with the accelerated 40 ES payments from individual taxpayers who want to get it in the calendar year for tax purposes?
Senator Hannon, Representative Morgan, I'd have to do some research on that. Or Representative Hayden, I apologize. I'd have to do some research on that for you. I can't give you that information off the top of my head.
That's out of curiosity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much. We're now pleased and honored to have Mr. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer. who's going to share with us the net effects of the slowdown in the economy and what it means on revenue projections. Welcome, Mr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer, and I told the revenue committees on Friday my job then was to ruin their weekends. So my job here is to give you something to think about here in the middle of the week. I think that the Office of Economic Analysis has given you a good, solid, objective forecast. Their job is to give you something that's middle of the road, and I think they've done that well. It's been well reviewed. A couple of things have happened. Of course, as Tom pointed out, things have changed since the forecast was released, and they're factoring those into account. Obviously, the Federal Reserve is concerned enough to make a pretty abrupt change in monetary policy. But I wanted to bring your attention to some scenarios that are not the midpoint scenario, not the baseline scenario, most likely outcome, but ones I think, at least two of the three I'll talk about, I think are very plausible. I think you need to be prepared for the possibility of either one of these occurring, particularly what I call my scenario A. But I've copied a couple of tables for you before I get into the scenarios, and these come from a report that was issued by the Rockefeller Institute out of a state of New York, in Albany, New York. There's a Center for the Study of the States there. And this was looking at fiscal issues over the next decade, and one that really caught my attention, and I think you need to be very aware of as you're making your budget decisions and looking out into the future, was to rank the states according to their importance of capital revenue from capital gains. And this is the Table 8, which is on that single-page handout. And what it shows is that the index is based on two factors. One is capital gains as a percentage of adjusted gross income. How important is it? In Oregon's case, a little more important than average, but not much. The second factor is income taxes as a percent of general revenue, and that's where Oregon is practically off the scale. 85% of our general fund revenue comes from the personal income tax. 69% of our total state revenue, tax revenue, comes from the income tax, the highest percentage of any single tax in the country. And you combine those two together and you have a ranking here in this table puts Oregon second most sensitive to changes in capital gains income. So as we look ahead, and of course what that meant for us in terms of the 1990s was very rapid revenue growth as the state was basically getting 9% of those realized capital gains. As we look ahead to a more volatile stock market and the realization that the stock market is unlikely to continue to grow as fast as it has into the near future, then we have to realize Oregon's revenue system is very vulnerable to changes in those capital gains realizations. The second...
Could you indicate for each percentage of a reduction in the capital gains at the federal level, what the loss in revenue would translate into loss of general fund revenue for the state of Oregon?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you look at the tax revenue that the state is, what's really built into the forecast for income tax revenue this biennium, it's about $800 million. That's the tax revenue associated with capital gains. Now, if the federal government lowers the capital gains tax rate, such as it did in 1996, you get more people realizing capital gains, and we end up with a windfall. In fact, the reduction from 39.6% top rate down to 20%, which was passed Congress in 96, I think that generated the next year about $100 million in additional income tax revenue for Oregon.
So the net effect is if it was lowered, it would be an increase in revenue?
If the federal government lowers their income tax, it's an increase in our revenue if we stay at 9%. Now, if we lower our tax rate, you'll have some increased activity in the first year because you've got people turning over assets.
Mm-hmm.
Over the long term, you still have a positive effect on capital gains income, but not clearly not enough to offset the reduced revenue from a rate reduction. In terms of what the magnitude of that impact would be on the state level, we've got a couple of bills that propose lower capital gains, and we're working on those revenue impacts. We'll have something for you in this session.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wesson.
Well, just, I mean, correct me if this is probably too simple an explanation, but we've got a 9% capital gains tax rate, and we generate approximately $800 million in general capital gains tax revenue. So just some simple division, and we get approximately what a 1% reduction in capital, or percent reduction. Would that be a fair extrapolation?
Mr. Chair, that would give you a rough idea. But the point I'm making here is that the capital gains revenue that we see now is at unusually high levels. So, you know, and the factors well beyond the tax rate are influencing that. So the point I'm making is the capital gains revenue stream is going to be volatile, and you're going to get widely different amounts of revenue, no matter what your rate is, depending on what happens to those realizations.
Representative Butler.
Paul, in that regard, there's a lot of talk about changing the death tax, and as we talk about changing the death tax, there's also some discussion about talking about no step-up in basis at a death. Have you done any calculations with regard to the capital gains impact if we didn't have the step-up in basis? Is that information accessible to you?
Representative Butler, we do have information on that, and as you know, the inheritance tax revenue for the state is just a pickup or a credit on the federal amount.
Right.
So whenever the federal government changes that base, that influences the amount of revenue that would flow to Oregon. So we follow very closely what those estimated impacts are, and so those are built into the forecast. As far as the specifics of changes in the estate tax, we've looked at that, but it's not really part of these scenarios today.
Yes, Representative.
Is there a link or relationship between a reduced state capital gains tax and the level of economic activity in Oregon? I'm sure there is, but is it significant or is it small?
Representative Ringo, that question I think gets back to one of the major issues that we'll have before the Revenue Committee's this session. As I said earlier, we do have some proposed reductions to either reduce the top capital gains rate to 4% or 5%. We know at the national level there is a relationship between activity. Certainly you end up reducing the holding period that people will hold assets, and you get some increased turnover. Whether there's a feedback effect in terms of economic activity, it's a little bit more problematic at the state level. And the reason for that is that we can have additional capital gains income from investment, but there's no guarantee that investment will occur in Oregon. Most of it comes from the stock market, which is well outside the effect on the Oregon economy. So... Mr. Chair, if I may continue, the other table that I brought really for to give you some initial sense, and this just really confirms the forecast that Tom talked with you about, but to give you some idea in comparison with other states, the other page of my first handout, this table 11 from that a report from the Rockefeller Center, shows you gross state product, which is not directly forecast by OEA, but it's clearly a part of the economic outlook. But shows that Oregon's forecast over the next five-year period, and these numbers are very consistent with your state revenue forecast, shows the biggest deceleration of any state compared to the prior 5 years. So this is we're not talking recession or anything like that. We're just saying that the expectation is Oregon, after very rapid growth in the 95 to 2000 period in terms of its gross state product, is expected to slow more than any other state. And I think you'll find that even without a recession, that is one of the significant factors influencing your fiscal outlook. Mr. Chair, now if I may turn to the recession scenarios, again, these are not what we consider to be the most likely outcomes, but we consider them plausible, particularly what I'm calling scenario A. There's several characteristics there. First is we don't go into recession, but we have a weaker economy than the baseline forecast. Weaker in the sense that we have 2% lower growth in personal income starting in the 2001 tax year. So instead of growing about 6%, we're assumed to grow about 4% for that two-year period. Still slightly above inflation, but not much. A fairly weak economy, no recession. The way I've timed this, you would still have a kicker. And I've taken 25% off of the capital gains forecast built into the December revenue forecast. Currently, that forecast calls for a reduction in capital gains from about $4.7 billion in income to about $4.3. So I've taken that all the way down, 25% down to about $3.2 billion. In my view, not implausible, given the uncertainties of timing. One of the real possibilities here with the market weakening, we may have a tendency for people to hold those assets longer, wait this thing out, and not have realizations during the down period, even if they may get a gain since they've held the asset for 4 or 5 years. So there's a very real possibility we'll see that depending on those timing. So if what I've done is taken 25% off the capital gains income, and on the numbers I have below there, I've divided personal income tax revenue into personal income from all sources other than capital gains. That's my PIT minus K gains. And then capital gains. That's where the $792 million comes in, built into the baseline forecast. So really all I've done here is I've taken the $792 million and I've knocked it down to $696, which, by the way, would be well above the income levels associated with the mid-90s, as recently as the mid-90s. That would knock $95 million off of your current biennium forecast. So you'd have a $367 million beginning balance to carry forward. With a weaker economy, I've assumed that corporate profits are flat. Profits are very volatile. They're likely to be flat in a weak, slow economy. They turn negative in a recession. So, and then allow them to grow 20% in the next biennium. So with this marginally weaker economy, admittedly sharp drop off in capital gains revenue, the bottom line for you in terms of policy making is you would end up, compared with the governor's budget, in net fiscal position of minus $641
million.
The fiscal position I've set here, the base I've set, is for the governor's budget to equal zero. And I've noticed I've plugged in the $99 million from the tobacco settlement to get you to a fiscal position of zero. And actually, the governor's budget with that in there would have a ending balance of about $103.99, of which is from the tobacco settlement. The other point here is that even with the economy coming back, in terms of corporate income taxes beginning to recover, you still have a fairly sizable hole in the next biennium. I think that's one of the things you'll find is that when you go into a weaker economy, you tend to have it stretch out over a couple of biennia. One of the things you've been able to do throughout the 90s is you've been in a position where you've been able to actually budget more than your revenue forecast. And the reason is because you've had a big beginning balance because revenue has exceeded forecast in the prior period. So you've had that built up. Even with a kicker, the kicker doesn't influence that ending, that beginning balance. So you've been able to spend those dollars above what the revenue forecast is. So that works in reverse. What happens when you have a revenue below forecast, you tend to have a very small ending balance. You cut basically back down to keep that ending balance as low as you can. Then you don't have much to carry forward. And the next scenario that I have here, that what I've called scenario B on the next page, just takes that plausible scenario a step further and actually looks at the results of a typical recession. And here what I'm saying is income is 5% below forecast. And, you know, the numbers that I think are helpful to think about here is our general fund revenue is dominated by the personal income tax. And if you look over time, given the kind of inflation forecast we have, you can expect that on average to grow about 6% a year or about 12% for a biennium. And that's about what's built into the forecast when you take out the effects of the kicker. What I'm postulating here is instead of 12%, a 7% growth. So still growth in terms of the economy, and that would be typical of a mild recession. You'd still get some growth over the two-year period. Recessions usually last only about 6 to 9 months in the post-war period. So you get revenue that's 5% below the baseline forecast, then I've assumed that it doesn't start affecting the revenue stream until the next biennium. So you still have a kicker triggered, and then you have capital gains income, as I've assumed before, 25% below forecast, and you have profits actually drop 20% this biennium and increase 40% the next. Again, a typical pattern for corporate profits. The mild recession would leave you, in terms of your current numbers and compared with the governor's proposed budget, about a $994 million shortfall in an 2001-03 period, which is about a 9%. So that's what you'd be looking at in the case of a mild recession, and one that I think would be a little bit, in terms of revenue, a little bit more severe than what you experienced in 1991, but certainly nothing like the early 80s. The last scenario is really tries to trace out, with a little bit of capital gains effect thrown in, tries to trace out the 81-83 period. And those of you, I know, Mr. Chair, you remember it well, and a number of other legislators recall those times. And if you kind of sort out the surcharges that occurred during the special sessions and looked at the forecast and compared with what actually happened, revenue was about 10% below the forecast. So instead of getting about 12% long-term growth, you get 2%. So you're actually below inflation. So your real revenue declines in this severe recession. I've assumed capital gains income would be even hit harder and drop 35% in this case. And I've got profits dropping 30% and then snapping back in 2003-04-05. I also have income snapping back and growing at the forecast growth rate from that lower level, lower base. But I think this is very similar to what members faced in the early 80s. You'd be looking at about, in relative terms, you'd be looking at about a $1.4 billion shortfall in both the 2001-03 and the 2003-04-05 budget periods if that were to occur. Again, this would be for a severe recession in the 2001-03 period and then a return to normal growth. So it takes you a couple of biennia once that happens to get back to some growth pattern. And again, I'm sure you recall from the 83-85 period, even though the economy began growing again, the budgets were still extremely tight because you'd ratcheted down to a very low level. So again, Mr. Chair, these are really to give you a sense of what the magnitudes are of what we consider to be plausible. I would say scenario A is the most plausible alternative to the baseline forecast, which is, I think, the most likely. Scenario B is I wouldn't consider likely, but still plausible. Scenario C, with a very severe recession, I think is, while plausible, and we've experienced it, is not likely to occur. And I would put a pretty low probability on scenario C.
Thank you for making my last term in the legislature so unanticipated, because having survived the 80s, when we had about 5 or 6 special sessions during that time frame, I would prefer not to relive that time frame. So I hope that option C does not repeat itself.
I do too, Mr. Chair.
Senator Trell.
These are scenarios, and they're scenarios. It's not what necessarily will happen. What about a scenario that said that we would have the December forecast with a small improvement? Is there any chance that that could happen?
Senator Trell, there's very definitely a chance that that will happen. I think CORA made it pretty clear revenue, the revenue stream has not started to tail off yet.
Mm-hmm.
As she mentioned, that withholding receipts were above forecast. They were above forecast, but the forecast is it builds in a pretty significant slowdown. So, I mean, the forecast is certainly not based on the idea that we continue to grow very rapidly.
But it's based on slow growth, but some growth.
Based on some growth, slow growth. I guess my biggest worry, Senator, again, is this capital gains phenomenon, because had played such a big role in the 90s in generating revenue beyond expectations.
Yeah.
That you can see it on the other side playing a similar role on the downside. The other thing to keep in mind about the revenue stream is, given the system that we have, our income tax system, it's very vulnerable to changes in certain types of income, particularly for high-income people. You know, when we think about a recession, we normally think of unemployment and the problems that that causes for a lot of your constituents, and that's certainly the most visible element. But from the revenue stream, you look at where the dollars come from. About 40% of the revenue comes from filers above $100,000 income, and less than 50% of their income is wages. A lot of it's capital gains. A lot of it comes through for various types of business income, like partnerships and proprietorship income. So those income sources are those people may not lose their jobs, and they may still have a pretty decent income compared to the general the public in general. But revenue is very closely tied to that. And when they have a down year, we really see it in terms of our revenue stream. So that's my biggest worry, as you see a slowdown there on the revenue stream, whereas the economy may limp along, but you lose those dollars coming in.
Stock market is so volatile, though, and it goes down one month and up the next month, and you talk about record highs and then terrible drops and then record highs again and so on. It is hard to know, I agree, and it may well be that that it's going to go down, but it may not be.
That's certainly true, Senator. We know it has gone down. I mean, the NASDAQ has lost about 50% of its value in the past year. But it also, of course, gained 96% the year before. So you have to put that in the proper context. And I'm not saying that necessarily that certainly these are the only plausible outcomes. It could be that we could have a stronger revenue stream.
Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the scenario B, you said that economy enters recession in 2001. Income goes 5% below forecast. But kicker is still trigger. So how can kicker be triggered if income goes below 5%?
Scenario B does allow the kicker to continue. I have what I've done is assume that you continue to get those with holding growth that's built into the forecast. Typically what happens is the spring payments, the final payments, are really where you see the most volatility because you have this netting effect. And if you have withholding continuing at the same growth rate, at the end of the year, if these particularly non-labor income sources are weaker, you end up with bigger refunds and smaller final payments. So it exaggerates the effect. So all I've done for simplicity purposes here is assume that we don't really feel the effects of on the revenue stream until we get into the next biennium. Well, in other words, the effects of the recession are not felt until the second half of 2001. Now, in the scenario C, I've began to slow the economy right away in 2001 tax year, and I've eliminated the kicker. That actually offsets some of the negative revenue effect.
Mm-hmm. I probably need to talk to you after the meeting to see why the kicker still triggers and the income goes below 5%. I have another question.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman. A lot of the companies in my district have laid off workers, large number of workers, because they're saying that their energy bill is exceeding their payroll bills in some divisions. Mm-hmm. So has this the same effect in other parts of Oregon where they have large layoffs because of high energy costs?
Senator Yee, the energy cost, Oregon is sensitive to energy cost differences. We, of course, are an energy importing region. We tend to get hurt by those higher energy costs, fuel costs. Some parts of the country, of course, benefit from that, as they're producing energy. For example, the Alaska budget now suddenly looks a lot better than it did a year ago. But we are disproportionately affected. I think it varies quite a bit across the state. We do have some industries that are not high energy using, particularly service industries are not as high energy. But manufacturing in general, whether it's high tech down through resource-based manufacturing, are dependent on energy, and that's a significant cost for them. So that's certainly one of the things that's slowing this economy down.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul, capital gains. I haven't heard you or Tom or Cora talk about the, so tell me how likely or unlikely or just naive this is. We've had, as you indicated, 96%, almost 100% increase in certain markets, particularly NASDAQ. The, Aunt Sally or Uncle Billy buys his stock at 20, goes to 120, and we get this 50% correction, you know, so it goes to 60. And, oh, I'm nervous. I don't like this. I'm going to sell, when he otherwise wouldn't have, creating a $40, you know, capital gains incidence.
Mm-hmm.
Have you factored in any of that into your concerns, if you will, with regard to reduced capital gains tax?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point. And I think that is the, you know, I mean, we talk about the unpredictability of the stock market and stock prices. Well, that's one thing. But the holding decision that individual investors make, that's a whole other area that adds another element of uncertainty. The situation you describe would help offset the loss of their decreases in the indexes, particularly if you have people that bought stocks in the early 90s or even in the mid-90s. They still have significant capital gains. They have some paper losses from their peak, but in terms of realized capital gains, they still could have significant gains. So that could actually help offset the losses that a lot of people talking about. If that's the case, then we would tend to have relatively flat capital gains. Again, if you look at the forecast, it does call for a reduction in capital gains income, not a huge reduction, but some reduction that would reflect some balancing between those two forces, between the reduction in prices and then those that are getting out of the market with some gain left. So, yeah, I mean, the forecast tries to build those in and recognizes that. It's just tricky to try to determine what people are going to do. Another thing that happens a lot with mutual funds is people basically give up control over many of those kinds of decisions. And so it's really the portfolio manager that's turning over that portfolio. And you don't know what you did until the end of the year when you get your tax statement. And the reverse of that, we saw a lot of people were making big April 15th payments because they realized, gee, I didn't realize I had these kind of capital gains until I got my tax statement. I got to pay taxes on. So you have that element as well, the portfolio manager is influencing that turnover decision.
Well, the rapid decline in the equity markets reflects not only a lack of buying interest, but a selling pressure. And with the, you know, tremendous increases in these markets over the last 5-7 years, you know, just my gut, and you have the numbers, I don't, tells me that there is still significant capital gains incidences that are occurring, and maybe is it possible we would get a spike in capital gains receipts?
It's possible, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the co-chairs would like to take this opportunity to thank the subcommittee chairs for chairing your respective subcommittees the last week and a half. As you've been doing the overviews here in full committee, we appreciate it. We're on schedule. So if we can keep our questions brief and to the point, we can maintain schedule and hopefully next Monday start the actual meeting of our subcommittees. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a comment to make?
Well, just wanted to emphasize, I think, what most of you already know. Our absence is not indicative of a lack of interest. We're back in the smallest office in the building, Chief Fiscal Officer Stinson's. It's crowded in there.
And we're combing the governor's budget looking for what he did and did not do, pluses and minuses in the budget. So we should have that wrapped up, I think, on Thursday, is it? If we stay on target?
Friday. If you show
well,
up...
Mike's laughing, so...
You show up, it's Friday. Mr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to make sure that the committee members knew that, we were not through with the full committee overviews. We have tomorrow morning scheduled what we call tools and techniques and processes that will be coming your way. We'll look at what the some of the documentation that the subcommittee will see. The instructions have been sent out to agencies that we bring you. So this is sort of the hands-on training time. Very important in particular for new subcommittee members. That is scheduled tomorrow morning at 8:30. We'll continue at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Any portions of it that we don't complete in the morning, and then we are also prepared to bring you the balances of the education and human service program areas that were not able to bring you in a lot of time previously, also to wrap up in the afternoon. So that is scheduled.
Okay. If there is no other discussion, we are adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning.
And then do we have a full on Friday? Three days at home? Do I get a permission to help you?